This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, how to save the nation tens of millions of dollars and otherwise healthy people unnecessary tests. How a potentially promising treatment for depression might be going rogue. The common sexually transmissible disease you've never heard of, which is hugely antibiotic resistant. And the myth of training your kids to drink alcohol sensibly. A study of more than 9,000 young people has found that those under 17 years old drinking alcohol each week, there was a 2- to 3-fold increase in the odds of binge drinking, drink driving and alcohol dependence in adulthood. It follows other research from the same team which tested the belief that some parents have that it's good to let kids drink alcohol occasionally. The study's researchers say it might be time to rethink underlying perceptions around when young people should be allowed to start drinking alcohol. In our Sydney studio is one of the authors, Richard Mattick, who's Professor of Drug and Alcohol Studies at the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. Welcome back to the Health Report. Richard, after a long break, too long.
Thank you, Norman.
So tell us about this most recent study.
This is a study drawing together four cohorts from around Australasia, from New Zealand and Australia. Separate groups, separate samples, and we integrated the data for 9,000 individuals. And we're interested to see whether exposure to alcohol early on led to problems later. The research previously has not been that well done. We found surprisingly...
So just to be clear here, so these are studies like in Dunedin and in Victoria, which have been following groups of kids from birth.
Yeah, they're mostly birth cohorts. There's one adolescent cohort, a couple of them are pregnancy cohorts, actually, so pre-birth. And the cohorts are now mature.
And snapshots of their health and well-being through their lives.
Yeah. They've been followed from birth and certainly through teenage years, and now their average age is 30-plus. So we've got their very early data, and then we can look at the adult consequences or the associations. And we found that early drinking was associated with quite remarkable problems in adulthood.
So what kind of drinking?
Well,
and how often?
That's where we were surprised. We thought it would be binge drinking or very heavy drinking, which would predict problems later on, but it's actually frequency of drinking rather than total amount that you were consuming. And we think it's habituated.
And how often? I mean, what are we talking about?
Up to weekly. And these kids are, this is before they're 17 years of age. So between 12, 13, up to 17 years of age, their drinking behaviours across that period.
And did it predict other things, such as, you know, there's other things that these longitudinal studies of adolescents have shown, such as early drug use is linked to early sexual experience and risky behaviour in general. Did you find it linked to that?
Well, it's the other thing we wanted to look at, because we were clear that the data in those areas were not that strong, and we found that once you control for the pre-existing problems, kids who acted out, kids who had peers who were involved in such activities, you actually found that those associations disappeared. Alcohol did not predict sexual behaviour, didn't predict poor outcomes in a range of areas. Alcohol use predicts heavy alcohol use, which shouldn't be surprising in some ways.
And was there anything, though, about the kids who did drink weekly or more that was unusual about them?
They tended to be kids who were more likely to act out, but we controlled for those behaviours and just looked at simple exposure. We had really good control of a range of different confounders, of different explanations, such as parental drinking, parental mental health, child mental health, peer behaviour. And once you removed all those effects, simple exposure to alcohol over and above those effects leads to heavy drinking.
So this is a bit like the tobacco story. If you're not smoking regularly by the age of 19, you're unlikely ever to smoke.
Yeah, I think it's exactly that analogy. That's my explanation, is that you give kids enough exposure frequently enough, then they get used to it. And in one way or another, however that happens, they start continuing to do the behaviour.
So it's actually training the brain when it's in a formative
state. It's
training
something. It could be cultural. It could be social. It could be...
But there's Melbourne research which suggests that if you use cannabis or other drugs in early life, in early adolescence, you can actually change the brain permanently.
Yeah, look, I think that research is really important, but speculative. I think there are simpler explanations, that you just get used to being involved with alcohol.
So let's go back to this research you published in January
with
George Patton at the Centre for Adolescent Health in Melbourne, which was about parental attitudes.
It was parental supply of alcohol. We looked at, we got a cohort of 2,000 kids. We've been following them for now about 8 years, and we looked at them after 6 years. And we found, contrary to the belief that parental supply was probably going to reduce their drinking, it actually did the reverse.
It did the reverse.
Yep.
So that's the link. In other words, it ties in with this, what you found in this study.
Yeah, parental supply should either improve drinking, because parents are trying to help their kids. That's the idea.
We're going to train them. They'll drink at the table and they'll see how mature adults drink.
Yeah, and they'll get over the novelty of drinking and it won't be such a big deal when they get to 18 and they can buy it legally. So the intention is really positive. The intention is very good. But there's three outcomes that can occur. You can get reduced drinking in the kids, so it's a good outcome. You can get no effect, so, okay, there's no benefit, no harm. Or you can get worse in drinking. And we were quite agnostic as to which way this would go. This research actually was started by ARMAC, the Australian Health Ministers Advisory Council. They essentially started the interest and started commissioning the research. It was funded by ARC. What we found was parental drinking actually made kids drink more.
Made kids drink more.
It doubled the risk of their drinking, binge drinking. It doubled the risk of them having alcohol-related harms. And at three times the risk of them having alcohol dependence symptoms. We didn't diagnose alcohol dependence, or as it's called now, alcohol use disorders. We simply looked at the number of symptoms, and they had much more symptoms than if they weren't provided alcohol.
And in this most recent study, did you know where they got the alcohol from?
Yes, we knew exactly, because we tracked them every year. We asked them.
No, the more recent one. So not the January one, this one.
No, the cohort studies which were done by the groups in Victoria and elsewhere in New Zealand that you mentioned were done about much broader health issues. They weren't focused on alcohol.
So what's the public health story here? Ban all alcohol, just reinforce the ban on alcohol under a certain age? The Americans have got it right. You don't drink till you're 21. I mean, what's going on
here? Well, I think there is a coherence with the evidence. New Zealand dropped their drinking age from 20 to 18 in 1999, and they tracked the harms in the society, and they saw a massive increase in harms. I think raising drinking the age of purchase of alcohol in Australia is unlikely to ever occur. But you've got this kind of group of people who care about kids, called parents, who think they're doing the right thing, and they've been somehow convinced by the industry that they should, or by the environment, that they should teach their kids to drink well. And they're either achieving nothing, because I think mostly the parental supply doesn't really harm the kids, but there is no evidence that it benefits them, and there is some evidence that it actually causes them harm. The message really is parents should not supply alcohol to their kids.
We've got it. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you.
Richard Mattick, who is a Professor of Drug and Alcohol Studies at the University of New South Wales and the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre. And we'll have reference to those articles if you are a parent and want to know more on the Health Report's website. And you are listening to the Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. I'm Norman Swan. Australia spends over $100 million a year on electrocardiograms. Some are done when you're lying on the table and some are done in an exercise stress test, usually on a treadmill. An unknown proportion of these ECGs are performed to screen for heart disease in otherwise healthy people at low risk of heart attacks and strokes. The US Preventive Services Task Force has just released a recommendation which argues there's no value in these tests in low-risk people, and questionable value even in people at medium to high risk, especially when you consider the harms that may arise from false diagnoses. One of the people on the task force was Michael Barry, Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. I spoke to him earlier, along with the President-elect of the Cardiac Society of Australia and New Zealand, Len Krithorides. Well, welcome to the Health Report to you both.
Glad to be here.
Michael, tell us the extent to which electrocardiograms, ECG stress tests have been used as screening methods for heart disease.
Well, here in the States, they've been fairly commonly used. There was a large study published recently that suggested that as many as 20% of adults were getting cardiograms as part of their general health checkups, even without any symptoms of heart disease or indications for doing so.
This advice from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is really focused at people who are adults who are otherwise well and at low risk.
Exactly right. And that's really important to emphasize, preventive care for asymptomatic individuals. The ballgame is completely different for people who may present with symptoms that would raise the concern about a particular disease, in this case, say, cardiovascular disease.
So this is like breathlessness on exertion, chest pain on exertion, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So what conclusion did you come to when you looked at the evidence?
We concluded for people at low risk, we could not find evidence that doing either rest or stress EKGs provided information that improved outcomes.
We should really define, low risk is defined by what's called an algorithm or a risk score, in your case, the Framingham one, where you look at your cholesterol, whether you smoke, your blood pressure, that sort, your age and that sort of thing, and you put it together in a computer program and you come out with a number, which is your chances of having a heart attack or a stroke in the next 5 or 10 years.
Exactly right. And with one small modification, the task force actually recommends the pooled cohort equations, which just add diabetes and race and ethnicity to refine the prediction a little bit. We would generally consider the low-risk group the people with a predicted probability of the next 10 years developing cardiovascular disease less than 10%. And then greater than 20% high risk and 10 to 20% intermediate. But for the purpose of the recommendation, for the low risk group, where the traditional risk factors would predict less than 10% risk, we could not find evidence that doing either rest or stress EKGs provided information that improved outcomes or meaningfully improved classification of risk. Sure. However, for men at higher risk, the intermediate and high-risk men, we really couldn't find evidence for or against including an EKG or stress EKG in the determination of risk. And there we really called for more research.
Len, is there ever a reason to do an ECG apart from when you've got, maybe you suspect somebody's got an abnormal heart rhythm or they're having acute chest pain, you think they might be having a heart attack?
There are, actually. Sometimes people have family histories of sudden death. We need to look for arrhythmic risk. People may have dizzy spells or syncope. We might suspect conduction disturbances. We may examine patients and find abnormalities like a murmur. We want to be sure they don't have outflow tract obstruction. So there can be specific reasons for doing an ECG, which are more than whether or not we're assigning risk of coronary disease.
I mean, this is big business. People doing what I would call, you don't need to call them, I'll call them remunerative ECGs without a good reason, which is really, Michael's being very polite here, but that's really what we're talking about, ECGs for no good reasons. The stress ECG, It's a completely useless test, isn't it? Even if you think somebody's at risk. I mean, you want to be doing a stress echogram, an ultrasound. A stress ECG is a lousy test, isn't it?
A stress ECG has its limitations.
It has just about being polite for your colleagues, is it?
I always try to be polite. It's about a 70% accurate test. It's less accurate than a stress echo. And, of course, incapable of picking subclinical atherosclerosis if you're trying to assign long-term risk of disease as a CT scan.
I mean, you could have a normal ECG and drop dead walking out the door.
You could, but if you have an abnormal stress ECG, you have a higher chance of dropping dead when you walk out
sure,
the door.
Sure, accepted. But you might be more accurate on an echo. Do you have any caveats on this, Michael, on your recommendation?
I'll stress the ones we started with and that we're talking about asymptomatic people. Recognition of subtle symptoms that should raise suspicion of a problem may be the thing to emphasize more than simply doing screening tests in people with no symptoms. And I think Dr. Chris Reedes has nicely given some examples where there's a clinical indication. You know, if I had an older man at high risk of developing a CVD event over the next 10 years who's been sedentary and might be thinking about starting an exercise program, that would be a different consideration. But what we were really addressing is the routine use of these tests in large groups of people for screening, and plenty of that goes on in the States, and I suspect elsewhere as well.
Len, whenever you do a test like this, there's a risk of harm. You find something that just means nothing. Everybody goes into a panic. You end up with a coronary angiogram. You have a stroke as a result of the coronary angiogram. And the original test was actually normal. What about pilots? They often get ECGs. Is the risk-benefit equation of having one of these tests when you've got no other symptoms worth it?
So this is a very difficult question, a good one too. And in fact, is discussed in one of these papers by the task force because they allude to the fact that if there's a greater risk than the individual's risk, for example, a risk to a large population, someone who uses dangerous equipment, a pilot, the criteria and expectations for safety are much higher for these people, and the expectations by legal bodies are that there are higher standards of safety in terms of the operator.
So you've got the US Preventive Services Task Force coming out with a strong recommendation here for people at low risk. What's the Cardiac Society of Australia doing?
The Cardiac Society guidelines at the moment, went through them recently, are really
swatting
all about
up,
how
I
you do
I take it.
How you safely do a stress test. But what they do in the existing guidelines is accept that there's a low yield for doing routine stress test in low risk people. What you touch on though is an important issue. Australia lacks a comprehensive guideline for screening of people beyond the establishment of an absolute risk calculation.
So what's the message here if people are obsessed with tests? Are there any tests worth doing if you're fit and healthy and you're trucking along in life?
We know that there are many people who have traditional risk factors, cholesterol problems, who are still smoking, blood pressure is high or controlled, and those are the levers that there's really good evidence make a difference. We know that there's an underassessment in general practice here, and I suspect elsewhere, of those traditional risk factors, and I would start there. And then, of course, as a generalist, I have to point out that it's important not to have tunnel vision on any one condition. There are cancer screening tests that people don't get. So thinking broadly about a person's health in terms of their risk factors usually gives plenty to do without doing tests of marginal value.
Look, thank you both very much indeed. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much, Norm.
Our pleasure.
And a longer version of that interview will be available on the Health Reports podcast, which you can hear on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Michael Barry is Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a member of the US Preventive Services Task Force. And Len Krithorides is the President-elect of the Cardiac Society of Australia. Transcranial direct current stimulation, TDCS, passes a small electrical current through a person's head using electrodes placed on the scalp. The technique has been trialled as a treatment for mental health issues such as depression and schizophrenia, and to see if it improves learning, memory, and other cognitive functions. Although researchers say that transcranial direct current stimulation still needs further testing, they believe some people have begun using the technique at home, sometimes with homemade kits. A team of Australian researchers say it's time to consider regulating the use of these medical devices. One of that team is Nigel Rogash, who's at the Monash Institute of Cognitive and Clinical Neurosciences. Nigel's in our Melbourne studio. Welcome to the Health Report, Nigel.
Hi, Norman.
So what do? Do you just sort of get a torch battery and stick two electrodes on your head? What happens here?
Well, to be honest, it is actually more or less that simple. We actually had some Year 10 work experience students who came in and visited us last year, and I got them to just to do some looking on the internet. And one of them actually built one and brought it into the labs for us, just using a 12-volt battery and some sponges from the kitchen. So it's quite simple.
Right. And does it give you a bit of a kick? I mean, what sort of sting is it on the head?
Look, it's not too bad. It's a very, very small current. So what people generally experience is a little bit of an itching sensation underneath the electrode. So nothing too major.
So it's not as strong as transcranial magnetic stimulation?
No, that's correct. It's actually quite different. So it's actually not strong enough to make the nerve cells themselves fire. So it does, we think, is it actually just sort of changes the speed at which the neurons fire.
And what's the evidence that it benefits anything at all?
Well, the evidence
sounds like magic
is,
to me.
It is somewhat mixed. So there was some initial studies looking at things like cognitive enhancement, so improving memory, improving language skills, that showed some pretty promising results. But some more recent studies have suggested that maybe those results were either a little bit larger than what we first thought, or maybe in some cases weren't really there. There's also been some research looking at the therapeutic benefit, as you mentioned before, so looking at treatment trials in depression. Again, there's some early evidence that suggests there may be some benefit, but it's still very, very early days in that kind of research.
And are there certain types of people who may benefit more? I accept what you're saying, that on average, it's beginning to become a bit questionable, but are there some people that you think have certain features that might benefit more?
Well, look, I mean, I guess the answer to that is at the moment we don't really know. I mean, it seems that, maybe people who have some kind of an impairment on a certain function might have some additional benefits compared to your average healthy person. But, we're still in the early phases of actually testing this with some good research.
So what's the evidence that people are trying it out at home?
Well, there's interesting things, like there's certain forums that you can go to on the internet that are actually quite well subscribed to, and people actually write into these forums and explain how they're making these devices and, what to do, and people post their experiences and these kinds of things on those websites.
So you've described what you think is a fairly harmless therapy. Are we getting overwrought about this, or is there a risk?
Well, there certainly are different safety concerns. So in terms of home use, I mean, when you're building your own equipment, one of the risks is actual burns. So you can burn yourself if you don't quite get the
current. So if a little current does you something good, maybe more helps you more. So you might.
And this is what some people think.
You might plug into the wall.
Exactly. You turn it up and then you can find yourself in quite a dangerous situation. I guess some of the other things is we know that under certain circumstances, the stimulation is quite safe. So we know that if you're supervised, if you're giving small amounts, say like a 20-minute burst, we know that that's quite good for sort of healthy people. But what we don't know is what happens when you give lots of stimulation. So if we get people that are you know, stimulating for, say, a few hours at a time, we just don't know what that actually does to the brain. And I guess this is particularly concerning for people like children, where we don't really know what happens with the developing brain, right? So there could be quite different outcomes of the stimulation depending on who's using it.
Going back to our alcohol story a few minutes ago, it could be changing the developing brain is really what you're concerned about.
There's a possibility. And I guess, as I mentioned, we don't really know at the moment whether it's safe in those sort of circumstances.
And do you put it just anywhere on the head, or is it like transcranial magnetic stimulation? It's got to be over a particular anatomic spot.
So the stimulation is a little bit more diffuse, so we don't have quite as good anatomical control. But some of the research that we're starting to look into now is, you know, where do you put the electrodes? How big do the electrodes need to be? These and, kind of considerations.
And is anybody having convulsions like ECT?
No. So the amount of stimulation that we give is well below the level that
So it's clearly a medical device. Just briefly, why isn't the Therapeutic Goods Administration regulating it already? Why do you have to call for this?
It sort of it falls in a kind of a grey area with the TGA's medical device regulation. So it isn't actually regulated by the TGA at the moment, mainly because of the way that it's marketed with the consumer-ready devices, where they're being, I guess, marketed as a form of enhancement for healthy brains. And this kind of allows them, I suppose, or the TGA has considered this not to be considered a medical device in this instance.
Sounds a bit of a stretch to consider it not a medical device.
And that's certainly what we were calling for in the paper, for maybe a little bit more consideration around these devices and how they're regulated, and, you know, whether we need to either broaden, I guess, the interpretation of the current laws, or potentially look at changing the regulation framework.
So maybe we'll put in a call to the TGA. Thanks very much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks, Norman.
Nigel Rogash is at the Institute of Cognitive and Clinical Neurosciences at Monash University in Melbourne. Mycoplasma genitalium, or MG for short, is a sexually transmissible infection that you've probably never heard of, yet it's really quite common. It can lead to infertility and premature birth in pregnant women. Mycoplasma genitalium is also highly prone to developing quite scary antibiotic resistance. But all is not lost. A team led by Melbourne researchers and clinicians has come up with a new treatment regime for MG that's already led to several countries changing guidelines for how best to treat it, and the approach may be applicable to other infections. The Health Report's producer Carl Smith has the story.
It's a sexually transmitted infection that many people haven't heard of. But some 400,000 Australians are believed to be infected with Mycoplasma genitalium, or MG for short. Doctors don't always test for it in routine sexual health checkups, and the STI often remains hidden because, like chlamydia, it doesn't always have obvious symptoms. However, Dr. Katrina Bradshaw from the Melbourne Sexual Health Centre and Monash University says MG can cause some big problems.
When it is symptomatic, it can cause urethritis in men, so that's burning when you pee and a discharge from the urethra, and infection and inflammation of the cervix, so the neck of the womb in women, and infection and inflammation inside the uterus, so we call that pelvic inflammatory disease. But it also has been implicated in miscarriage, premature birth, and triple factor infertility.
The standard treatment for MG is antibiotics. But Mycoplasma bacteria are unusual in that they don't have a cell wall. So many common drugs that target this part of the cell, including penicillin, don't work on Mycoplasma genitalium. Instead, the main first-line treatment has been another antibiotic called azithromycin. But recently, MG has been developing resistance to the antibiotics that do work on the bacteria.
We have actually been diagnosing this STI longer than most services in the world. And in about 2005, I had three patients that failed azithromycin. And at that point, I didn't know what to do. We had no resistance to azithromycin when we started using this drug. And about 15 years later, we now have more than 50% of MG infections in urban Melbourne and Sydney resistant. And we have seen the emergence of resistance to moxifloxacin, which was really our last options for many.
With first and second line treatments failing, Dr. Bradshaw reached out to some of the leading researchers on Mycoplasma internationally. They began work on understanding the bacteria, looking at how many people were infected and why MG was developing antibiotic resistance so rapidly.
Our group actually showed that if you have an individual who you treat with azithromycin, which has been the first-line treatment for Mycoplasma genitalium everywhere globally, 10% of individuals seem to go from susceptible to resistant, which is an extraordinary rate of selection of resistance and explains the rapid spread of macrolide resistance in MG and really the loss of that agent. We are running out of drugs and we have to be very clever with the drugs that we have.
But Dr. Bradshaw and her collaborators have come up with a new approach to treat the STI that's improved cure rates from around 50 or 60% to more than 90%. The team partnered with Australian diagnostic company SpeedX, which has developed a way to rapidly detect whether a patient has an MG infection and whether that strain is resistant to azithromycin. They also trialled using a different antibiotic called doxycycline as the first line of defence. Although doxycycline rarely cures MG, the bacteria hasn't developed high levels of resistance to this drug.
The first step was reducing the use of azithromycin, replacing it with doxy. The second step was implementing a resistance assay. So this would detect the organism and detect azithromycin resistance at that time. And the third step was then using that resistance result to triage patients into a drug that they were still susceptible to.
The use of doxycycline first appears to weaken the bacteria, increasing the chance for a second round of antibiotics to work, normally azithromycin or another called moxifloxacin.
So what it seems to do is disable the organism and reduce the organism load, which renders it more susceptible to the second agent. And what actually happened was we went from low cure rates of 50% really for our first line therapy to cure rates in excess of 90%, so 92 to 95%. So we had an enormous leap in our cure rates and most importantly, a great reduction in the selection of resistance. We can protect the azithromycin and slow down the development of resistance.
Some countries, including Australia, have already updated their national guidelines, suggesting clinicians use this new treatment regime. In fact, some nations did this before the team's research was even published.
People were aware of what we were doing in Melbourne, and so our resistance guided pathway got adopted by the UK guidelines, European, Australian guidelines. I would say that this is very much an interim measure still. It's really not optimal antimicrobial stewardship to be approaching control in this way. So our next step really is to look at combination therapies. And then really the last real game changer is moving ahead to point of care. What we really need to do is diagnose an STD at the time the patient first presents and have a resistance result at that time.
Will this new technique be useful in treating other STIs, for example, gonorrhea as well?
There is an urgent need for a molecular resistance test for gonorrhea too. And yes, it would be a similar approach. And yes, these are under development.
The Health Report's Carl Smith was talking to Dr. Katrina Bradshaw from Monash University and the Melbourne Sexual Health Centre. I'm Norman Swan. This has been The Health Report. Do join me next week.